This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Peoples and Things, where we explore human life with technology. I'm Lee Vinsel. Hey, everybody. You may have heard me mention the Peoples and Things podcast derives from a class I taught at Stevens Institute of Technology, where I was before Virginia Tech. And whenever I taught that class, I like to begin with what I believe to be the simplest and most helpful definition of technology, which is the things animals use to achieve their ends. And then we focus on peoples. We put the things in a social picture. Specifically, I focus on the idea of social networks. And we ask questions like, well, how does an individual come to know how to use their things in their environment to do what they want to do? So we talk about children learning from parents and teachers, maybe becoming apprentices or entering forms of advanced education. So we start with a basic picture of people and things, or maybe in this case, things and people. Well, where do you go from there? I think the next step is that you have to put this most basic picture in society. You have to think and talk about peoples, different societies in different places and different times, and how material things and activities around them were a part of those cultures. And here's the thing. If we think about what have been called complex societies, that is not cultures made up of small kin-based groups, but more complex cultures featuring the division of labor and trade, increasing amounts of architecture, political systems, maybe even a state, when we look at those kinds of societies, then a typical feature is social hierarchy. Some social order that divides people into those on top and those at the bottom. Indeed, I don't know if this is still true, but at one point I learned that social hierarchy was a part of the very definition of a complex society. And the reality of peoples and things has, for nearly all of human history featuring settlements, been a part of such social hierarchies. These hierarchies determine, for instance, who does what kind of work, with what kind of tools. For instance, in some cultures, it is untouchables, the lowest people in the pecking order, who clean out latrines and toilets. Social hierarchies also determine who has access to certain material objects, such as luxuries. For example, across much of the world and throughout long stretches of history, various cultures have had what are called sumptuary laws, which literally limited which groups were allowed to attain luxuries and extravagances. They were meant to ensure that people lower in the social ladder looked the part and stayed there, where they belonged. Now, when I teach students about how technologies are a part of social hierarchies, I typically focus on a few things. I focus on work, who does what with which tools. I focus on segregation, how people are spatially divided up. And I also focus on design, because as we all know, many groups, whether women, people of color, the disabled, you name it, have been and still are excluded in how various objects have been designed and made. But what I really like to do when I talk through these various ways in which social hierarchies influence the relationship between peoples and things is to focus on race in the United States. I talk about the role of technologies in slavery and Jim Crow and the civil rights movement and racial inequalities today. And for a long time, there were ways to do this, There were certainly books and articles I could give students to learn about the racial dimensions of technology, but not many. For instance, for many years, there was very little I could give students on how American Black people related to transportation and to cars in my class on the history of the automobile. Well, now we are lucky. One might even say we're blessed, because although much work remains to be done for sure, the last few years have featured a blooming of many books on race and technology. And I'm excited because we are bringing you one of my favorites, Mia Bay's Traveling Black, A Story of Race and Resistance, a book that I really like and I look forward to teaching for a long time. In this conversation, I talked to Mia Bay, a professor in the Roy F. and Jeanette P. Nichols Chair in American History at the University of Pennsylvania, about the long history of how Black people related to different forms of transportation that emerged in the late 19th and 20th centuries, and how the legacy of slavery and the realities of Jim Crow shaped their experience with these technologies. We also talk about the role of transportation technologies in the civil rights movement, both as sites of resistance, such as buses, and as tools of resistance, as was the case with automobiles. Our conversation ends with a discussion of what this history has to teach our moment, including the realities at the heart of the Black Lives Matter movement. Because so many instances of police brutality begin with traffic stops and the dangers of driving while Black. I hope you enjoy our chat. I had a lot of fun talking with Professor Bay, and I'm very grateful to her for writing Traveling Black. Hey, get excited. Mia, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Traveling Black's a wonderful book. Like I said, I told you earlier, I really look forward to teaching it especially. I think it's really great. When you explain to people what it's about, if that's something we still do in these kind of pandemic times, what do you say and what were you trying to do with this book?
Well, when I first started talking about the book to people, I said it was a social history of segregated transportation, and then the sort of thing was like, you know what it was like to travel in Jim Crow cars and ride at the back of the bus. And that was what I was trying to get at, what was actually entailed in segregated transportation, which was sort of more than seemed obvious to me from just the idea of like separate forms of transportation. And I was also trying to figure out how it moved from one form of transportation mm-hmm. to another, which no one had ever really explained as far as I could tell.
Yep. And how did you come to write this book? You have earlier books on kind of African-American intellectual history and Ida B. Wells and other things. So how did you as an individual end up turning to transport?
I ended up turning to transport partially because I wrote about intellectuals. I wrote about, for instance, a biography of Ida B. Wells, an anti-lynching crusader and Black journalist whose career in both activism and journalism first took shape after she was kicked out of a ladies' car in Tennessee in 1881. And I found that, I mean, for her, that this sort of experience of sort of being told that she couldn't ride in a car set aside for women kind of dramatized this sort of complicated world of race and gender in the late 19th century South. And I found that was true for other women as well. And that sort of made me curious also just about how we went from ladies' cars to Jim Crow cars. And but beyond that, in looking at intellectuals, one thing that became increasingly clear to me, especially if you look at Black intellectuals, is to even understand people's ideas, you have to get it. You have to kind of deal with the complexities of their lived experience, mm-hmm. especially when there's sort of stuff going on that is, you know, sort of actively sort of on their minds as they sort of formulate their thoughts.
Yeah. I really like this point you made in the introduction and elsewhere that, you know, it's these kind of more Black intellectuals, these more elite folks, Black entertainers who are experiencing this travel discrimination a lot more than often than other people were, right? So it was like in the front of their mind more often.
Exactly, because the black intellectuals are sort of talking to a population that's both in the South and the North, and they're moving back and forth across the regions. They're traveling a lot, and they're more likely to be able to travel than people with less money or people who, let's say, are rural Southerners working on farms. So they experience all of this kind of first and more often than other people.
Yeah. I was wondering too, just kind of like on a, you know, in a methods way as a historian, when you first started on this project, you know, how did you start thinking about where to look? And this is something I've thought about, you know, I teach a class on the history of the automobile, and I've done some research on black transportation just for teaching purposes. Mm-hmm. And it's such a diffuse topic. I mean, you know, it's not like you can go to like three archives and you're going to have this beautiful big story. You got to look in all these different places. So how did you start thinking about it and, you know, approach it as a research problem?
I approached it as a research problem. I mean, it was different for depending on the technology. The trains are the subject of a lot of litigation, and so are buses in a certain way. So court cases were a good window in. I found black newspapers tremendously helpful. Black journalists are another group that encounter these kind of problems regularly.
Yeah.
So they sometimes report on their own problems, and they're also pretty happy to report on others. But beyond that, I don't think this book could have been written without the internet. So because with cars and airplanes, I did things like do Google searches on Negro and then old words for car like jalopy or sliver or whatever to find these kind of, you know, in random publications.
Yep.
Reference discussions of, or I actually at some point realized Negro and chauffeur was a good combination because that's the way a lot of black men first start driving cars. So just kind of, and then the, you know, results would include everything from trade magazines, you know, to court cases, to newspaper reports. So casting the net really wide for the diffuse stuff.
I have also in my own work found, especially for like, before 1925, whenever copyright cuts off, it's really, you can get so much just in Google Books looking at for these terms, right? It's pretty rich.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Travel discrimination is a really important concept, at least early on in the introduction, and segregation. I mean, did you think there are certain concepts that you wanted to frame up in the book that were important to you to get a hold of, like, across to readers?
Absolutely. You know, I started working on the book around the time of the Katrina hurricane. So I was very aware that, and then I also lived in New York City, which is a city, you know, in which many people have to travel hours to get to. So I was very aware of travel discrimination in the daily lives of commuters, in the lives of, you know, black and brown populations that don't have cars and are stuck in New Orleans following the hurricane. So I did want to get to travel discrimination as an issue, but I also wanted to kind of understand why it was so central to for African Americans, why so many different people across different sort of politics sort of take this, you know, take up issues like the Jim Crow car as major issues.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, you kind of already mentioned it, but one of the things I really appreciate about your book, because I've been looking into this issue of race and transport for so long, is you do track across all these different modes. Like, we have good books on streetcars, we have good books on aviation, but like, we really have been missing this more synthetic and overarching picture. And another thing that you point out, you know, time and again, is that we often tend to not look early enough and like go back. So, you know, where do you see travel segregation and these travel discrimination issues start to develop historically? And, you know, what do we miss if we don't look earlier in the 19th century, I guess?
I mean, I think we miss, broadly speaking, the really big issues it takes up. I mean, travel segregation, this is all been a debate among historians about the origins of segregation. And I guess the thing this travel discrimination suggests is we need to sort of disaggregate segregation to even understand it. Travel segregation is closely timed. The beginnings of various forms of travel segregation and discrimination really is closely linked to emancipation in both the North and the South. Those things happen at different times. It's also mm-hmm. closely linked to the things like the development of railroads and sort of significant numbers of common carriers. So it's a history that has to do with the both the technology and also the sort of phenomenon of emancipation and then also urbanization, because what do we develop these common carriers for? Often to sort of move people from city to city, which produces new kind of anxieties about proximity, especially because it coincides with emancipation. So we have to think about all these things together. And when it comes to thinking about travel segregation across different modes, what I came to realize kind of late in thinking about the book, and maybe could have emphasized more in the introduction, is just that, you know, to understand the history of travel, you need to understand travel as people actually do it, which is to say, we make decisions constantly about whether we're going to take the train or drive a car or take a plane. Like, you don't just sort of do one, but so when we write about just one, we're not kind of understanding the choices people are making.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, like, abstractly in popular history, but certainly in academic history, we know that segregation affected the railroad system and that there was the Jim Crow car. But I also mm-hmm. think, like, you just bring so much more richness and detail to that story than I'd ever seen before, including where it leads off with this gentleman. I think it was a doctor who, like, had, like, clothes to travel on the train because, like, it's so filthy and stuff. I mean, it was mind-blowing. So, I mean, what do you think is missing about, you know, what do you think it is kind of missing in the popular history of the Jim Crow car that you wanted to draw out for readers?
I really felt like the way in which, and this is sort of, we kind of know this in the abstract about separate but equal. We certainly know it about schools. It's not just, I mean, it's the reverse of separate but equal.
Yeah.
It's separate but sort of everything inferior. And in technology, not unlike schools, again, this kind of means that you get the old, worn-out technology. You always get the worst seat on whatever form of transportation you're traveling on, if you're traveling black. You know, which in trains, there's really terrible seats on 19th century. I mean, there's like mm-hmm. entire terrible cars. The Jim Crow car is an old wooden car, you know, which is more likely to completely collapse in the event of a crash. Mm-hmm. All of these things, which I don't think we had really come to terms with. People knew them at the time, black travel. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, why people protested, especially the Jim Crow car, so fiercely, was they were aware that it was it was miserable to travel in often, and it was dangerous, and it had like very few of the amenities that were sort of normal in railroad cars. And I think, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was I felt like people were kind of forgetting it. People wrote about Jim Crow and the railroads often through the lens of the courts, which almost never took up the issue of what exactly was entailed in the so-called separate but equal arrangements.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, because I feel like that's what it was, the experience of the car that I had, you know, I'd not seen so richly portrayed before. I mean, just details, like, not only did this guy have, you know, kind of overalls, or dirty overalls to travel this way because it was so filthy, but that those cars were often used for, like, transporting livestock and chickens and stuff like that. You know, it's just, like, wild.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine? My God. So, you know, in this system, we could talk about streetcars. We could talk about other earlier kind of modes of transport. But obviously, you know, the automobile held out a lot of promise for African Americans. Mm-hmm. And you can mm-hmm. see, you can see people being excited about it, like W.E.B. Du Bois clearly likes mm-hmm. to drive, right? He likes mm-hmm. his car. And you have Jack Johnson, you know, he loves his car and these things, even though obviously, you know, it leads to his downfall in some ways. But, you know, there is also, the car also came with its own problems. And you example, there, examine, there's this entire racialized and racist system built around the car. So I guess one place I want to start, where do we know about like the earliest automobile users and what they experienced?
Well, I mean, as you probably know, the earliest automobile users are almost kind of hobbyists, right? You know, like, you know, cars kind of developed before roads.
Yeah.
And early cars are really difficult to drive. But they do experience kind of exclusion early on, Jack Johnson being a case in point. He wants to, you know, he wants to start a career in car racing, and he's not, you know, he's the Automobile Association, the American Automobile Association, which controls car racing at that point, you know, or is like, you can't have a license, you're not,
yeah,
you're not allowed to. And there's also hostility towards early black drivers because the car represents a sort of, you know, a desirable wealth object. So there's,
yeah,
cases of early black car owners being sort of dragged out of their cars and beaten up, or their cars being destroyed. So it's you know, it's a kind of controversial object for blacks to pick up from early on. And then, and then when cars are at the point where they offer people a certain freedom, which is to say you can drive long distance in them, you begin to get this development of a kind of system of hotels, motels, service stations, in which there are forms of segregation. In the South, they're mandated by law, but they also occur in the North, where they're sort of customary.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the car was such a class-based object at first. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's like Woodrow Wilson said that automobiles are like the best argument for socialism ever because there was so much class hostility. This is like in 1907, he says that or something.
Oh,
like
really?
That.
Wow.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. So, I mean, and, you know, in just what we know about race and class, mm-hmm. in the United States, like black people are going to tend to have less money than white, mm-hmm. folks. Like, what do we know about the earliest automobile owners and, you know, like how that plays out? Is it like used cars become very important, I imagine, for these folks? Or
yeah, no, the earliest automobile owners among blacks are people like Jack Johnson, other kind of well-to-do blacks who are using them, who are buying them and using them the same way other rich people are.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time you get to World War I, when you have like the Model T, keep in mind, a lot of black folks at this time are rural. So
yeah,
you have black Southerners buying used Model Ts. You also have, in World War I, there's this shift from white chauffeurs to black chauffeurs, partially due to labor shortages, also due to the fact that over time it becomes sort of clear to Southern whites that a black chauffeur is actually more useful than a white chauffeur. He can be required to chauffeur the car and do other things as well, whereas initially the white chauffeur is kind of this sort of technological expert,
yeah,
who doesn't do much else aside from maybe take your daughter out, which was also
one that was a problem
known for. Whereas the black chauffeur could be sort of incorporated into the household service.
Yeah.
So you have around World War I, you have things like sharecroppers when there's a good cotton year, and there were a couple buying used Model Ts. You have black men working as chauffeurs and developing the kind of technological expertise in the automotive industry. Well, in taking care of automobiles, it allows all these kind of used cars to stay on the road.
Yeah.
And then you have formed from there on, you have forms of black car ownership that may not be obvious to us today. Entire extended families share a car. People own these used cars that are not always working.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
But there's a lot of, you know, people who can kind of get it to work for a limited amount,
yeah,
of time.
Yeah.
So people kind of revolve in and out of functional car ownership.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Earlier you mentioned how we start to see the development of these hotels and restaurants and, mm-hmm. these segregated spaces. And obviously one, you know, kind of famously now there's been a lot of attention paid to the Green Book. There was a film made about it and such. And we have these travel guides, you know, that develop that help people kind of, you know, navigate where to get to these places. But what do you think the popular version of the Green Book story misses about these travel guides and the longer history of these things?
A couple of things. I mean, I was the movie The Green Book came out while I was writing, as did sort of a flurry of articles about the Green Book. And I kind of felt like it misses out on the story in a couple of different ways. One is, of course, that The Green Book is by no means the only travel guide. It's the only one that's known, but it was, you know, it comes out of a long, you know, it's not the first. There's a history of these travel guides that goes back to just before the Depression. And even before then, there are these kind of more informal guides that are being circulated among Black musicians. And the Green Book actually has ties to that. Ernest Green, who develops the Green Book, is he or his brother-in-law is an agent for some Black musicians. So it's literally built off existing lists and very much in this sort of infrastructure Black vernacular knowledge. But then the other thing is sometimes when people are writing about the Green Book and also in the movie, there is this kind of idea that the Green Book is the book that actually solves the problem of where to stay. Once you have the Green Book, you're good, which I don't think anyone thought at the time. I mean, the Green Book, for one, this is before the internet. The Green Book was often out of date. The businesses that it listed were often somewhat ephemeral. They were underfunded Black businesses. And as one user complained around 1940, like the Green Book didn't really, he was sort of saying that it doesn't really tell you which one is almost a whore, which were the hotels is almost a whorehouse, you know? You got a choice of three and you don't know which one is the brothel.
Right. And clearly, I mean, it doesn't solve a lot of other problems because you're going to face discrimination and violence and all these other things.
And you're also going to face, and this is, this came out in the 1964 Civil Rights Act hearings, you're also going to face just having to drive a tremendously long time between these establishments, to the extent that it was actually kind of dangerous. It was like a longer time than recommended by the highway safety guidelines.
Right. So, you know, this period that the early part of the book looks at, the late 19th and early 20th centuries, obviously featured like the creation of all these new transport forms. And as we talked about, you know, one of the things you're tracing is how segregation is kind of moving between new technologies. So how did Jim Crow segregation and these forms of discrimination come to be applied to air travel when it starts to emerge?
Yeah, that was fascinating. That was actually the first chapter I wrote because I had no idea whether it would be a chapter or like 10 pages. Because, clear whether the sources are there. I mean, in some ways, it was like the other technology. There was always this kind of phase where the new technology emerges and it's supposed to be for elite, technologically advanced white people. And this was true with early air travel, even to the point where air travel kind of originates as individuals flying planes, and Blacks are discouraged from participating in this. There is, you know, people like Lindbergh, you know, say this is the sort of talent of the master race, the greatest accomplishment of the white race, and so forth. And then it seems to segue pretty, I mean, there's not enormous numbers of early Black flyers, but from early on, initially, there's kind of an absolute exclusion. People are simply refused entrance to planes. Then at a certain point, it becomes clear that planes are indeed common carriers, which is to say, if you sell a ticket to something like an airplane or a bus, you have to carry everyone. That's sort of old English law that we have here. And then they start to find ways to seat the usually individual or single Black passenger on early planes, which are relatively small, you know, by him or herself, usually himself. And then we get to this, again, familiar story of what is, in fact, the worst seat on a plane. And it took me a while to figure out why the front seat, which was for a while the worst seat on the plane was the worst seat on the plane, but of course has to do with propeller planes and how noisy and filled with sparks that was. And then when that is no longer the worst seat, the seat becomes, it becomes more like isolating the passenger in a row by him or herself. It's never official segregation on planes, and it may not even be that extensive. It's a little hard to tell, but it's extensive enough to, I mean, you know, that I did find many references to it. And actually, oddly enough, my mother actually experienced it when she, I once asked her, well, before I started this book, I was like, you know, what was your experience of flying, mostly because she was a very nervous person, and I she had been very, very scared, and she was like, it was in the 50s, and she was seated next to the only other black person on the on the plane. That's what, and she thought it was an incredible coincidence. That's what she remembered.
An incredible coincidence,
and it was not a coincidence, as my book tells you. This is, it's actually the way they would seat black people if it was more than one of them on a plane.
And the other thing you cover is just that, you know, and this is something that obviously goes across multiple transport modes too, is just the construction and reconstruction of space to create in the airports, right? You end up with the same kind of waiting rooms and seating and these kinds of things, right?
Yeah, no, there's a, I mean, there's a you know, a deep commitment and a legal commitment in the South during the years that airports are being constructed into constructing segregated space. So they find ways to do it, even though airports are all constructed with federal grants that actually have, you know, are supposed to not actually support segregation. They find sort of legal loopholes, ways around it. But it's so airports are being built with various degrees of segregation, usually restrooms almost and almost invariably restaurants well into the beginning of the 60s when the Justice Department finally puts an end to it.
You know, the civil rights movement, I had another guest I had on recently, just interviewed this week, is the African-American historian Joe Trotter, about his work, recent book, Workers on Arrival. It's this kind of big history of African-American labor going all the way back to the beginning and coming up to the present. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the civil rights movement. It really encompassed so many things. Like with Joe, I talked about the labor side. You can talk about lunch counters and restaurants. But I feel like the transportation aspects of the civil rights movement, whether it's Montgomery or the Freedom Riders, it's just so iconic as a part of the movement. Why do you think it, I mean, why was it such a, you know, why did it play such a big role in the movement? And why do you think it strategically, the civil rights leaders were focusing on it?
That's a good, well, I mean, I'm not sure it was strategically what the civil rights movement leaders planned to focus on. I mean, Montgomery, a lot of transportation projects, sort of protests actually start, you know, out of what's going on the ground. Certainly in Montgomery, you know, it's, a lot of women with a, I mean, there's sort of a long history of hostility between bus drivers and blacks in Montgomery. By the time you get to the bus boycott, black men are barely even riding the buses if they can avoid it, because the kind, you know, because the kind of disdain that they're treated with sometimes leads to fights. And you have, you know, women kind of planning to start a boycott well before it happens, and then only when it, when they do start it, is, you know, do we have leaders like Martin Luther King being called in. And the NAACP has sort of, is, it has, you know, it during the Depression, when the NAACP has to kind of choose its cause, it, it chooses education over transportation for good reasons. It also emphasizes anti-lynching over transportation, but transportation keeps coming up because it's so much part of people's daily life. And also because it, you know, poses these kind of moments that, you know, in which people are in real crisis. So you just keep having court cases that are not necessarily always organized by anyone who's planning to make this as a major, major deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's, I think it just, it has, It's a national problem.
Yeah.
It's something that people often confront as individuals, but in ways that sort of lead them to pursue a court case, or in the case of things like local buses, do a bus boycott.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just I guess it's also like with schools. I mean, yes, school segregation was horrible, but there were ways in which people were attached sometimes to their segregated schools, trying to make them work, not entirely averse to the idea of just getting equalization
yeah.
funding or improvements. But the transportation segregation just didn't work because the rules were different from state to state, from region to region.
Mm-hmm.
You could end up in trouble with segregated transportation without ever having, you know, having planned to cause any kind of protest.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that really has interested me for a while, and I did some research on it with a grad student using Black newspapers, is the role of automobiles and carpools in the civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
especially in Montgomery. I mean, in King's memoirs, the carpool plays a big role in kind of mm-hmm. making it possible. So how do you think the car played a role in just like the relationship between these different modes of transport for the civil rights movement leaders?
The car, yeah. You know, the car, for all that people experienced a lot of forms of discrimination, driving forms of discrimination that sort of led them to, you know, be wary of service stations, to sometimes travel at night, to go certain routes. The car, on the other hand, also did offer certain kinds of freedoms. And one was an alternative to public transportation. I mean, as I said, in Montgomery, a lot of Black men had already stopped riding
yeah.
the buses. If there was a one-car family, maybe the man would be riding the bus, driving to work. And it made, you know, it made the boycott possible, though not without difficulty, because as you probably know from King's thing, you know, insurance became an issue
yep.
for the boycott carpool. There were all sorts of attempts made to kind of shut that down.
Yep.
But there was still some possibility of autonomy, and even insurance could be secured elsewhere, and there were ways to get gas if local gas stations weren't supplying it.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating story, I think. I mean, and there were like multiple waves. I think if I remember correctly, there was... they first wanted to use taxis, Black-owned mm-hmm. taxis, to basically circumvent the bus system, and the city cracked down on that in a big way.
Yeah.
So it's just like multiple ways. You see the kind of activists trying these different strategies, and then the city would try to close that down. So it's a really fascinating story. So a number of court decisions and eventually legislation made, you know, segregation of transport illegal, but what did the process of desegregating transportation look like on the ground? Because, I mean, you can have court decisions and stuff like that, right? But, like,
right.
It takes a while. It's a process. It's not like it's going to happen overnight. So what did...
Well, and then also, I mean, the court decisions that desegregate really start coming as early as the 40s. And they're just sort of Southern courts, Southern businesses find ways around them. The carrier, in the Morgan case in Virginia, it's ruled that Virginia cannot segregate its buses. The carriers begin to segregate buses and trains. And even after 1961, when the federal government finally kind of cracks down and says this is going to be enforced, you know, people still have to kind of get it through their heads that they can actually ride in whatever part of the car that they want. But I think the challenge is that, I mean, one of the things that white Southerners hope that is with or without the law, people would just continue to observe segregation
yeah.
rules. And that did not happen precisely because, the accommodations for Blacks were so inferior. People didn't continue to simply observe segregation. And then you also get things like the Freedom Rides of 1961 And the cases that precede that, like there's the Boynton case where you just have a, you know, a college student who decides he's going to eat at the white bus station counter. So I think it takes, but I mean, what I take from the whole story is that it takes more than court cases. It does take direct action protests, often by people who are actually simply trying to claim the legal rights that they already have according to the courts.
Yeah, totally.
So the subtitle of your epilogue is hashtag Black Travel Matters. And clearly transportation plays a huge role in the Black Lives Matter movement. If we think for a second about how deadly encounters with police so often start for Black people. So after after doing the work of writing this book, you know, what do you want to tell people today? And what do we learn from the history of race and transportation that maybe we fail to understand or recognize?
I guess one thing I learned was that, you know, there's a way in which infrastructure can be invisible to us, especially to those of us who are not really having problems with it, you know. So, like, if you have a car, you may not be aware that the public transportation in your neighborhood is abysmal and you can't get from one place to another. I mean, I think it tells me that we need to pay more attention to that and how those decisions are made, which are usually made in all sorts of ways that actually don't take into account the sort of needs of a broad spectrum of people.
Yeah.
Broad spectrum of people. You know, I've long thought that transportation inequity, and it's sort of muddied by the whole pandemic work from home thing to some extent, but I've long thought that transportation inequity was sort of, especially given the way the housing market operates, sort of the sort of new, was heading to new heights, you know, just because, especially in the Northeast, you have people ending up living, you know, 2-3 hours away from where they live by public transportation. Is that a sustainable way of living? Is that a sustainable way of organizing people?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and now with climate change, that's even a bigger question. We have to think about how we just have to think actually more about how people get from one place to another, whether it's fair and equitable and whether it's destroying our planet.
Yeah, totally. No, I really like the, you know, some of your reflections in the epilogue about kind of the devil's bargain around cars for Black people, for not only for the, you know, driving while Black type issues, but just what it means for cities and the environment and all these things. It's such a huge question that we're stuck with.
Yeah, and one that seems like it grows more pressing all the time. And it seems like as we try to address either one of those issues, either be it the environmental toll of cars or transportation inequality, we actually need to try to think about solutions that address both of them at the same time.
Yeah. And the other part I loved about your epilogue, this was actually something I was thinking about doing sometime, is going down and actually like riding buses in Montgomery and checking them out, right? And I love the fact that you wrote about like, what is the bus system in Montgomery look like today? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you say, you know, it's far from something Rosa Parks would idealize, right? Even though it's been desegregated in quotation marks, it's pretty far from ideal.
No, it's pretty far from ideal. And today, you know, the Rosa Parks equivalent of today, someone with a white collar job probably isn't taking the bus. The buses don't run often enough for anyone who has any choice to take them regularly.
Yeah, and I guess someplace I've ended up thinking a lot the last couple of years about this is the civil rights movement is this moment, right? It's this famous moment. It comes together for particular reasons. It falls apart in particular ways and in particular time. And we have the legacy of those things, you know? But whether we look at education or transport or voting rights or all these things, they're not battles that can be won at one point in time and then it's over, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, I also felt like your book is in parts like calling in the end to that we need more forms of activism around these transportation issues.
Yeah, I think we do. And we need, I mean, you know, it's difficult to say because I mean, the fight to actually desegregate, you know, these buses, trains and so forth was so long and so hard fought.
Yeah.
It seems hard to ask for more forms of activism.
Yeah.
But the fact is that, you know, activism is this kind of long game that people have to kind of continually be involved in. And here I would go back to Ida B. Wells, who in her autobiography, she described herself, drawing on a biblical metaphor, as she often did, as a sort of watcher on the walls of the gates of Jerusalem,
uh-huh.
always on the lookout for injustice. And I mean,
yeah.
I do think that we, you know, like, just sort of trying to create the task of trying to create a better society, it's never like it's over. And
yeah.
we go through cycles of backlash in particular in this country.
Mm, we're in one of those right now, unfortunately, aren't
exactly.
we?
Exactly.
Yeah. So what's next for you? I mean, do you have a next project you're working on, or are you taking a break?
No, I mean, circle back to the project I was working on actually before I started this book, before Traveling Black kind of hijacked my
uh-huh.
research agenda. And that is a book about African American ideas about Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, cool. I love that. I mean, I haven't read your I think it was your first book maybe, but you mm-hmm. wrote about African Americans thinking about white folks, right? Was your
yeah.
early work?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
now you're thinking about like Jefferson as an example and kind of
Jefferson in particular,
yeah.
because one of the things I found in the research for my first book is that he is actually much discussed in 19th century black newspapers as as both the best and the worst of American democratic
yeah.
thought. So, I want to return to that and kind of look at the way he emerges as a central figure in black thought during the 19th century and sort of what people do with that.
That's cool. That sounds wonderful. And I mean, are you going to bring it up? I mean, you know, obviously, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting Jefferson, the woman Jefferson was in a relationship with, but...
Sally Hemings.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's been a lot of rethinking his legacy recently. Will you come up and examine that, or do you want to really focus on that earlier period?
No, I think I will examine that in one way or another.
Yeah.
It's sort of challenging to figure out exactly how to do that, but it seems like it's overdue, and yeah.
Well, Mia, this has been great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
All right. Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of our podcast. You can reach us with questions, comments, and suggestions at leevinsel@gmail.com or by following me on Twitter at STS_news or on YouTube at People's Things. Our podcast is distributed by the New Books Network, the leading platform for academic podcasts, so that you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. People's and Things, like most things in this world, depends on the work of many people. I want to thank my brother Jake Vinsel for writing the music for the show. I want to thank my buddy Juliana Castro for designing the logos for the podcast. You can check out her work at julianacastro.co. Joe Fort is the producer for the podcast, and Mandy Lamb is the production assistant. This podcast and other People's and Things programming are produced in affiliation with Virginia Tech Publishing and supported by the Center for Humanities and the University Libraries at Virginia Tech. For information about other podcasts from Virginia Tech Publishing, visit publishing.vt.edu. For the entire People's and Things team, I am Lee Vinsel. And most importantly, I want to thank you for listening. Thanks. Thank you.